Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Sarah.
And I saw something funny on our Facebook group, and it was also on Twitter. Oh. And it was like, you know the things where it's like, what's your stage name? And it's your middle name and your pet's name.
Yeah.
Well, this one was, what's your Nazi fighting name?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was your first name plus your last name.
My Nazi fighting name is Sarah Lerner.
Yes, and mine is Devin Handy.
Oh, my gosh. Everyone, figure out your Nazi fighting name. Not hard.
Not hard.
We can all do it. I love that. I know. That's so brilliant. People are so brilliant on the internet.
I know.
Sometimes people are really shitty, and then sometimes people are really brilliant
and,
you know, kind and great. I'm like, you know what? I have some faith in the internet.
I know. That's why Twitter, it's like, it's the best and the worst of people.
Really,
like, there's
is.
No...
Someone was asking me, someone wanted a quote for some article from me, and they asked, how does Twitter factor into your, like, personal activism?
Uh-huh.
And I pretty much said that. I'm like, it can be really shitty
right.
to be a woman on the internet. That being said, I think I'm a better feminist because of Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, that was basically my answer. So yeah, it's kind of the best and the worst of everything. But I just can't quit you, Twitter.
No, you cannot.
I really can't. Again, we've talked about this on the podcast. Devin has a hellbent rule.
Yeah.
When we go out to lunch together, I'm not allowed to even look at my phone.
Yeah, right.
Which is good. I think that's a good rule. I generally, when I'm like out with people, try not to look at my phone.
Because
I've definitely hung out with people who, when we hang out, and they're literally on their phones the entire time. And I'm like, I get it. Sometimes I want to peek at, you know,
sure,
especially
whatever.
In this era.
Absolutely.
Like, so much is happening with Trump. Like, I get it. Like, 20 minutes can go by and he's like tweeting about potentially starting a
nuclear war.
Like, legitimately.
Right.
But yeah, there are definitely people, sometimes I go out with them and they're just on their phones. I'm like,
why am I here?
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, and also I think part of self-care, which a lot of people ask us about and talk about, I think part of it is like, when you're eating,
mm-hmm.
like, disconnect just a little bit.
Just,
you know, just, like, focus on eating,
focus,
you know, or...
Focus on the present.
On the present.
Who you're with.
Exactly.
Enjoy their company. Totally agree. Okay, so let's go through what we're going to discuss today. First, we're going to start out with listener feedback and some general updates on our end. Our second block is continued coverage of Charlottesville. A lot has happened even in the last couple of days, and specifically in regards to this so-called president/occupant of the fucking White House.
See, I love that. Occupant of the White House.
Block three is our interview. We get to chat with Matthew Cherry.
I'm so excited about this.
Yeah, he's a former NFL player and now is a filmmaker, and he is creating a great short film called Hair Love. So we're going to be talking to him all about that. Then after that, we get into our gratitude check, which we always love. And then because it's Thursday, we have our Hellion of the Week. And it's a good one this week.
It is a good
one. It's a really good one. And then finally, we have some action items, so stuff you can do after you listen to the show.
Okay, Sarah, so let's start off, as always, with some listener feedback. So what do you got?
Well, first of all, we heard from Laura B. Sharp, who is the woman whose Facebook posts I shared as my gratitude check in the last podcast. And just for quick context for those who don't remember, Laura had shared a story about her and another woman basically, like, completely owning these two dickwads at a cafe.
Oh, so beautiful.
It was glorious. So we have that linked in the show notes from last week. So
yes.
If you want to read it in full, I highly recommend it. Well, she emailed us and she said, "Thank you so much for sharing my post. This page is awesome." And then she said, "Love your invisible middle-aged angry woman friend."
Yes. Yes.
And I love this so much because, like, that's going to be my aesthetic when I'm older.
Yes.
It's just like an angry, quote-unquote, invisible middle-aged woman who just gives zero fucks.
Well, yeah, I found that as I've gotten older, I just give less and less fucks.
Rapidly shedding fucks.
Just dropping them like flies.
My sister would say.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I hope that I am the person in a cafe who's like, nope.
Yeah,
like,
totally. Like,
go fuck yourself.
Be the Laura B. Sharp.
You want to see in the world.
You want to see in the world. So thank you, Laura. It was great to hear from you via email as well.
Mm-hmm. So there was a great tweet and made us laugh. It said, quote, now a monthly Patreon contributor. You had me at bonus podcast, where we really let our hair down, / it gets a little tinfoily.
we call it tinfoil hat hair.
Tinfoil hat hair.
We take off our tinfoil hats, and then we have hair. The hat hair. Yeah. The tinfoil hat hair.
Exactly. Yeah. And we do really, like, let our tinfoil hat hair down, and we, like, banter and, like, make jokes that are kind of worse than they are here.
They're like 1,000% worse.
Worse, yeah. Yeah.
We definitely, like, as irreverent, so to speak, as we can be on here, our Patreon definitely has a looser vibe.
It does.
It's like after hours hellbent.
It
and
is.
Like we bants like no one is listening.
Bants like no one is listening.
That's what we do. Yeah. It's a jolly good time. And I will say, Devin did an interview with one of our Hellions.
Yes.
Who is a lawyer extraordinaire.
Yes.
Liv.
Yeah.
And she's in the Facebook group as well. And I was listening to it on the way here today. It's so good.
Thank you.
And we're getting a lot of really good feedback on this interview. It's really, really good. Liv is really, really smart. Devin's asking really great questions. So
I answered the pop quiz question right.
Oh, I don't think I got to that point
yet. Yeah, she gives me a little pop quiz.
Oh, gosh.
And I was terrified. I was like, I'm going to get this wrong.
That's amazing. Well played, Liv.
Yes.
So anyway, that tweet definitely made us laugh. And again, tinfoil hat hair. It's a thing on Patreon. Okay, so this is from Ruby via email. She said, quote, I was so sad to hear that you were removing the Maxine Waters Award. Then you explained why. More than any other behavior, the willingness to accept our mistakes and grow from them makes great leaders, great innovators, and great human beings. It is humbling and inspiring to hear the two of you run as hard and as fast as you can toward the discomfort that comes from discovering you are wrong. It's a privilege to watch you grow and to learn from you. Thank you both for always being a shining light in the darkest timeline.
Oh, I know.
That definitely brought couple tears to my face.
100%.
To my eyes.
And this, it echoes a lot of the feedback we got about the decision to remove the Maxine Waters Award.
And then rename it
Hellion of the week. We're glad to see people react positively to us owning up to our shit and kind of pivoting and trying to just be better feminists and be more intersectional. And introspective and really listen to what people are saying and see how that really applies to our life.
And be better.
And be better. It's hard. And there is power in admitting you're wrong.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of times people do wrong unintentionally.
Right.
Doesn't mean it's any less wrong, but I think that, you know, being able to recognize when you're unintentionally doing harm is a good thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think like we mentioned in our last podcast, letting go of like that defensive wall that's kind of built on ego and pride, like we all have that.
Right.
That's never really going to fully go away, but letting go of a lot of that, it feels great. And it does wonders for personal growth. Like 10 out of 10 would recommend.
Would do again.
Yeah. So thank you to all the listeners who gave us that feedback.
You
know, I think we felt like it was really important to be open about why we were changing it, moving forward. And like we said, to kind of own up to our shit.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's the difference between growth and
being stagnant.
Yeah. And you know, people, white guys, who double down on their shit when they're called on it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not helpful.
And white women do it too.
Of course.
That's why, I mean, I literally, that's the part of my brain that I access.
Right. Like,
when I get called out or like,
right,
we were talking about when we see something that's written and we recognize ourselves and
right,
we're like, shit.
Oh, crap.
Oh, my gosh. That's us. I always, that's the part I access in my brain is like, how would I want a white guy to react
right
to me giving him feedback that I feel like is important?
And then we do that.
Well, we do the opposite. How they usually respond
versus
don't do that. Yeah. So anyway, thank you to everyone for giving us that feedback. We definitely feel confident in the decision and we stand by it.
Yes. And then finally, a little update. Hellbent is now on Spotify.
Woohoo!
And even better, they don't censor the F-bombs in our episode titles.
They don't.
They do not.
You see on iTunes, it's like stars.
It's like every title is just a row of stars.
Row of stars. Spotify is like,
nah.
We see you.
We see you.
It's fine.
All right, motherfuckers, let's do this.
Okay, Devin, so let's get into our second block, which is the continued coverage of Charlottesville, because even more shit has happened on Trump's side, and there's a lot to go through. So first of all, Let's talk about this bananas press conference that happened on Tuesday at Trump Tower.
I mean,
can you summarize what the fuck we witnessed?
I can, maybe, because I'm not even totally sure that we know exactly what's going on.
No.
Like, in whatever. So he held this press conference, like you said, on Tuesday at Trump Tower, and he managed to dig himself into an even deeper hole than he had already dug.
Yeah,
which is honestly almost impressive.
Saying a lot. saying a lot.
Wow. Mm-hmm. He said, quote, "I think there is blame on both sides."
Again with the both sides.
I mean,
you can't let that go.
Well, and the thing is he's literally both sidesing us.
Mm-hmm.
This
mm-hmm.
is like what your like dude bro douche friend, quote unquote friend from college does. Well, on the other hand.
Well, actually.
Yeah.
But this is the worst well, actually.
Exactly.
This is beyond the scope
of well, actually.
This is beyond that.
He said, quote, "You had a group on one side that was bad. You had a group on the other side that was also very violent."
Very violent.
Violent. Nobody wants to say that. I'll say it right now. Oh, so brave.
Yeah, he's like, no one wants to say
no
it, but
one
me.
Wants.
Like, I'm a martyr. No.
No.
No, 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 no.
Fuck you. You are not.
But then he said, quote, "I've condemned neo-Nazis. I've condemned many groups. Not all of those people were neo-Nazis. Believe me, not all of these people were white supremacists by any stretch."
So if you're not a white supremacist, what the fuck are you...
White supremacist.
White supremacist. What the fuck are you doing at a white supremacist rally?
Well, that's the thing. And I loved what Chris Rock had tweeted. He said, quote, "If 10 guys think it's okay to hang with one Nazi, then they just became 11 Nazis." Alt-right / white supremacists, it's just Nazis. Fuck Nazis.
Yeah.
Which is so true. It's like, you can't say that, you know, not all of these people were, you know, neo-Nazis. They're surrounded by neo-Nazis.
Right.
They are themselves Nazis.
Yeah.
Like,
and there's not, something...
This is not hard.
This is something... There's something to be said about, you know, you're defined in part by the company you keep.
Yeah.
And you should be aware of...
But there's no excuse. There's literally no excuse.
Oh, no, I'm saying...
No, I know.
I'm saying, like, if you're hanging out with whites, not
but I don't
with
even
Nazis...
Think, I don't even think they can say, "I was just hanging out with Nazis."
No, that's what I'm saying. They can't. Like, that's what I'm saying. That's what Chris Walker is saying. Like,
yeah.
If you hang out with Nazis,
you are
a fucking Nazi.
Yeah, by process of elimination.
Exactly.
You're a Nazi.
I also personally loved Chief of Staff John Kelly's face during the press conference.
Yeah.
It just really said it all.
Yeah.
He was looking down and you could tell that he was pretty mortified, to which I say, like, look at your life. Look at your choices. You're here.
Yeah.
Like, I don't feel bad for you.
Oh, no. There's no feeling of bad.
Yeah.
But, like, no shit. Like, this is this, like, so-called president, this occupant of the White House / Trump Tower.
Right.
Is a national fucking embarrassment.
Right.
He has been since he announced his campaign for president.
Exactly. And you... And
like,
you...
there is no pivot. None of you can help him. None of you can be a moderating influence. Like, you being... in the White House isn't going to help anything.
Well,
like, there's no point in trying to change Trump.
Well,
right?
You know, Tuesday was the day he really became president.
Oh, I follow this comedian named Megan Amram.
Yeah.
And she tweets that literally every day. It
mm-hmm.
makes me laugh because it's just like all the pundits who like were like, you know, give Trump a chance or maybe he'll change. Or
that joint address.
This is the day he became president. All of you, egg on your face.
Yeah.
No.
Right?
Okay, let's also talk about Trump's use of quote-unquote alt-left,
mm-hmm.
because there were some strong feelings about it. And my friend at Einstein Trom had a thread about it that I more or less agree with.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, quote, "Trump misused the term alt-left to describe normal people who dislike Nazis. In the process, he severely delegitimized the term itself. In the past, I and others have used the term to refer to a fringe left wing that has racist and sexist undertones and devalues social issues. But I want to make it very clear that we never meant anything close to what Trump said when he used that term. We were talking about a fringe left that criticized Hillary severely, then voted third party or abstained. I don't want Donald to be able to use the left as cover for the right's disturbing and blatant association with vile hate groups." So what are your feelings about, you know, what Trump is doing with alt-left, the term alt-right? Like,
yeah,
walk us through how you're feeling.
Well, I mean, I agree with her. Like,
mm-hmm.
I feel like she's saying a lot of what I'm trying to articulate.
Yeah.
I think that the term alt-right is a confusing term right off.
Well, yeah, and it's just kind of a euphemism.
It's right. It's
straight up like a rebrand.
Exactly. So, I mean, I feel like it's it's not a political ideology so much as it is a worldview. So every couple of years, Nazis do some rebranding and repackaging.
Yeah, didn't Rachel Maddow have a segment about that?
Yeah.
She talked about how they've, like,
they
changed
cycle,
the names of themselves to try to, like, appeal more broadly.
Yeah, and they, you know, they kind of change their political tack a little bit, and they, you know, they change how they raise money, and, you know, so they're Nazis, they're KKK, they're the New Order, white supremacists, the alt-right. It doesn't really matter. It's just, they're all terms for Nazi.
Right.
They're all terms for...
Neo-Nazi, white supremacist.
Yeah, yeah, whatever. It's just all Nazi. It doesn't matter. I mean, you know, there's a few other titles that I'm sure they thought were very clever.
In a way, it matters because they're trying to soften.
Exactly. But that's what I'm saying. It doesn't matter what they call themselves because they're still fucking Nazis.
Right. Like, they'll never be able to convince us that they're not Nazis.
Exactly. And, you know, they're using these, like... quasi-political terms, like you said, to sort of soften it and to be like, well, it's not Nazi,
to
it's
seem
alt-right.
There's an air of legitimacy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they're using it to lend that air of legitimacy.
And you saw news outlets sort of give them an assist in this way.
Exactly.
I'm thinking of Mother Jones, for example.
Yeah.
They, like, had some feature earlier this year about Richard Spencer, and they literally called him, like, dapper.
Yeah.
Like, the dapper alt-right. And it's like... they helped him mainstream.
Right.
That,
exactly.
Which is really creepy.
Right. And so alt-right is a term that they're using to sort of cover themselves with political ideology. And so I think using the term alt-left is just a false equivalency.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's kind of like saying, I'm not even sure. Like, that's the thing. I was so confused by his use of this term alt-left that it didn't really make any sense to me.
Clearly, he was trying to use it to create a false equivalency.
That's what I'm saying.
And basically, like, do you feel like both of those terms are just not specific enough?
They're just not specific enough.
Yeah.
And it's like, so if he's going to use the term alt-left to mean anyone who opposes Nazis, that's, you know, literally... everyone on the left. So
it's literally every civilized
person. Exactly. Yeah. So it's just sort of like, if that's what you're trying to define it as, like, that doesn't make any sense. And so I just think that the use of these terms, it's a really great way to confuse everyone.
Yeah.
And to sort of use
to mask what's going on
and to sort of play the shell game of, like, what we're calling Nazis now. Like, it doesn't fucking matter.
And what we're calling people who oppose.
And what we're calling people who oppose Nazis, which it
Yeah, so I'm pretty much in agreement with the thread we read from at Einstein Trom. You know, Trump weaponized, quote-unquote, alt-left, like, this term to both sides the shit out of what transpired.
Right, that's it.
In Charlottesville.
Yeah, he's really just using it.
But so now it's become untouchable. Now it's a term, like, you know, I think given this circumstance, I think it's prudent to not use that specific phrase anymore because he's trying to create a false equivalence.
Exactly.
That being said, for me, that doesn't mean that the racism and sexism that does exist on the left still, you know, that it doesn't still merit critique, because it does. And trust me, like, I personally have been on the receiving end of some pretty bad harassment from dudes who identify as quote-unquote progressive.
Right.
And it's not fun. It really isn't.
Not a fan.
Yeah, and actually, Ijama... Oluo actually had a great Facebook Live yesterday. I don't think you can access it right now. I think she might have deactivated her accounts for a week for sort of like self-care purposes. But she talked about how people on the left are kind of exploiting this old debate around quote-unquote alt-left to blame and target women and people of color for Trump using that term. And that isn't okay either.
Right.
So it's frustrating because, you know, ultimately, like, this Jewish bitch... AKA me, like, just wants to defeat these fucking Nazis.
Right.
Like, that's definitely priority number one.
Right.
And I would hope that we can all agree that we should be focusing on that.
Exactly. And not these terms.
Instead of fighting over terms. And also, in the process, you know, going, like Ijama Oluo said, going after women and people of color who were using quote unquote alt left to not mean what Trump meant.
Exactly.
That's not what they meant. And
right.
I think we can, I mean, for me, I feel like it's not a term that anyone should use anymore. But because of what Trump has done, because of the way he's weaponized it. But I'm just like, I don't want to have a fucking debate about this.
Right.
I just want to defeat Nazis.
Well, that's
like,
the thing.
Like, eye on the ball.
Eye on the prize here. Well, and I think that for me is kind of what it felt like Trump was doing, was using these terms to be like, well, let's talk about this.
Well, yeah. I mean, he was trying to make it sound like there are people on the left who are Nazis, and it's just not true.
Exactly.
And I think, like, a good rule of thumb, just in general, I was talking to a friend about this, is when you want to call something specifically out,
yeah,
be specific.
Right. Like, use something precise, like, language.
Something like quote-unquote alt-left is kind of nebulous, and then in this case has become weaponized,
right,
to create a false equivalence that doesn't exist.
Exactly.
So I think that's just a good rule of thumb. Okay,
yeah.
So let's move on from that to talk about the spin that's coming from Jared and Ivanka's, like, PR wing. So as Pod Save America's Tommy Vitor so tidily summed it up, it basically amounted to, quote, "We tried to sway him, but we were on vacation, so Dad sided with the Nazis."
Yeah, and did you see the rabbi who helped Ivanka convert just tore Trump to shreds?
Oh yeah, I did see that.
So good.
But also, can I just say that, like, this line that they're like, "Oh, we really tried to tell, you know, Trump to not side with the Nazis, but he did. Oh well, we were on vacation." Can I just say that that is obviously a crock of bullshit, because my Jewish mother gave me more grief for trying to get out of an advanced math class in middle school than Ivanka allegedly did trying to convince Trump to not side with Nazis.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying, I don't quite believe him.
Yeah, right?
Like, come on.
Yeah, right.
We don't buy this. Also, apparently all of the eldest Trump children, so Don Jr., Eric, Ivanka, they unfollowed Marley Matlin after she tweeted, quote, "America fought secessionists in the Civil War, Nazis and anti-Semites in World War II. Do we blame, quote unquote, both sides? The answer is no then and no now." I'm like, listen, Ivanka, don't try to convince me. You tried to convince your dad not to side with Nazis when this little tweet probably caused you to unfollow Marley Matlin,
yeah,
along with your asshole brothers.
Exactly.
Like, no. No one believes this shtick. Like,
right,
this is just getting pathetic.
Right.
Like, no one believes this.
And especially in the light of this article that her rabbi actually wrote.
Right.
It's like, please do not give me that.
No.
Like, everyone knows your rabbi doesn't believe
you're
you.
You're full,
like,
of shit. You were never, quote unquote, moderating,
yeah,
influence.
Like,
you don't
please stop.
You're fine with all of this.
Right.
Clearly.
Yeah, and, you know, I really feel like this is using the assumption that Ivanka, which is my new favorite term, had any sway over Trump in the first place, and
yeah,
they so clearly do not and did not.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I feel like we could go back and look at all the articles of, like,
yeah,
them trying to, like,
yeah,
push him to do something about, you know, like, LGBT rights or
yeah,
climate change. It's like,
right,
no, full of shit. It was full of shit then. It's especially full of shit now.
Exactly. And I feel like even if they did have sway over him in any way, shape, or form,
yeah,
I have no doubt that they would just close their eyes and run the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and this is the logical extension of, you know, well, it's not me he hates. It's just people like me.
Oh, you mean, like, coming from someone like Jared?
Exactly.
Right? Like, that's a thing. And it's something that I think about a lot as a Jewish person.
Right.
I talk to with Jewish friends. I'm like, I get that there are Jewish people who voted for Trump ostensibly for, like, tax-related
right,
reasons or Israel or whatever. I'm like, but at the end of the day, I still don't understand how you could be a Jewish person and vote for someone like Trump.
Well, right. I mean, it really comes down.
I genuinely don't understand it.
I mean, it's sort of like Trump is using this, like, well, I have a Jewish friend. My son-in-law is Jewish, so
right,
I can't be a Nazi.
I can't be an anti-Semite.
Right, exactly. And it's like, well, that's not really how any of this works, but, you know.
That is, yeah, that is the oldest excuse in the book. No one believes it.
Yeah, and it's sort of like also this line, like, Trump isn't really responsible for the Nazis. He just kind of agrees with them, but it's not like he was at the rally himself, which is an actual answer I got from an actual family member.
No.
So, yeah, when I asked them about it.
No.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. He won't really condemn them because he identifies with them
right,
on some level. And those are the people that rode him to victory.
Exactly.
So he's not going to stand up to them.
Right. He's not going to, you know, talk about his base in, you know, negative terms. He's just not going to. I mean, in neither of these positions, it's not me he hates, just people like me, or like Trump isn't even there, like wasn't at the rally. I mean, neither of these
doesn't make sense. It doesn't matter either.
But asking for common sense here is a little bit like asking a fish to ride a bicycle. Like, it's just ridiculous.
Well, you're saying it's never going to happen.
It's just never going to happen.
Yeah.
It's not.
And I think this
going to make sense.
This goes back to what we were sort of talking about on Monday about how people tried to make, you know, for a long time, like, oh, Trump voters aren't racist. Like, it's just about the economy.
Right.
And it's like we're seeing every day how wrong that is. For what I, you know what I mean? Like, I think people have tried to soften what Trump is all about.
Oh, yeah. You know how I feel about softening the discourse.
Yeah. And it's clear now more than ever that that this sort of racism that he has amplified and emboldened is a feature.
Not a bug.
It's a feature. Like,
it's true.
And I think, you know, Andrea Grimes had a great article in Dame, mm-hmm. which is an outlet that Devin and I both do work for, about how mostly white media is ill-equipped to deal with these issues.
Right.
And they're almost kind of a tool of a racist state. It's
right.
almost like this self-reinforcing, you know, yeah. narrative.
Right. It's like a perverse symbiotic relationship, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know, where they benefit from each other.
Well, it's not even just that. They're just not able to talk about race.
And get underneath
it. So then we don't ever have these larger discussions in mainstream media about
right.
race and racism because a mostly white media is not able or
they're not getting,
willing to want to have those discussions.
Right. They're not getting down to the really meaty questions.
Uh-huh. Okay, so let's move on to reactions to this bananas press conference. So first of all, apparently on Tuesday it was hashtag National Relaxation Day, which is just like ill-timed.
Yes.
The Twitter's official Twitter account tweeted a poll like asking how people were spending that day, and I was like, I'm angrily tweeting.
Right, exactly.
Like, what do you think I'm doing, Twitter?
Like
read the room.
Figuring out how to punch Nazis.
Like, I know, there's all these journalists I followed that were like, I just filed 3 stories about Nazis. Like, how the fuck
are you doing? Like, what are you doing?
Yeah. And this might sound kind of naive, but it does feel like this could, like, sort of this reaction to Charlottesville and to Trump reacting to Charlottesville could be a turning point. Like, I'm not necessarily holding my breath, but the backlash has been pretty strong. Like, there's quite a few examples of that.
Yeah, I mean, so Trump had to disband his CEO advisory councils after a handful of business leaders publicly announced, you know, their resignations. And it was definitely a situation of, you didn't break up with me. I broke up with you.
Yeah,
like, I ended this.
Like
you just...
Well, it wasn't even that. It was just like, I know you're going to break up with me, so I'm going to dump you first.
Exactly. Like, right. Like, you didn't break up with me.
Yeah.
I totally did it.
Yeah.
It was totally mm-hmm. mutual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a lot of the CEOs resigning explicitly stated that they were resigning because of Trump's mm-hmm. response to the Charlottesville terrorist attack. The Federalist, which is a conservative outlet, ran a headline that I think might be my favorite headline.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump needs to not be president yesterday.
I mean, yeah. But we've been trying to tell all you fucking people.
Well, like, yesterday.
No, yeah. And even a Fox News host, Kate Timpf, in immediately reacting to Trump, the Trump press conference, said, quote, I'm still in the phase where I'm wondering if it was actually real life. I have too much eye makeup on to start crying right now.
Yeah.
She's like, I don't know what to do.
Right.
So even like someone on Fox News is like, what the fuck is this
yep.
even? And then a Confederate statue was removed by activists in downtown Durham on Monday. And then early on Wednesday morning, Baltimore's mayor had 4 of the city's monuments removed. But then across the country, 2 cities are moving to remove old signifiers of the Confederacy. And I just, like, I want us to be very clear. You know, removing these statues isn't sort of ridding ourselves of historical lessons, so to speak. You know, as Jameel Smith tweeted, quote, all of these folks worried about erasing history when the Confederate statues come down will be thrilled to learn about the existence of books.
No, it's so true. I don't understand why we're so attached to this failed rebellion. Well, I mean, I do. White supremacy.
You know, that all being said, you know, the sort of reactions and the backlash, you know, as of this writing or as of this
recording,
Only 16 of 292 Republicans in Congress have released statements that call out Trump directly. And from what I can tell, no senior staff members have resigned.
That many Republicans, huh?
Mm-hmm. But that's it.
Yeah. No, that's what I'm saying. I mean.
Yeah. And, you know, Mike Pence also doubled down on Trump's bullshit by saying that he spoke with Trump about Charlottesville and that, quote, I stand with the president and I stand by those words.
Anyone who thinks that Mike Pence is better than Trump, doubling down on this shit. Doubling down on it.
Well, yeah, I mean, for a while I was convinced that Mike Pence would not be as bad.
Right.
And then we spoke to Melissa McEwen last week, and she convinced me he would be at least as bad.
At least as bad.
And so go back and listen to our interview with Melissa McEwen, because that is, she made a very convincing argument that is backed up by facts.
Mm-hmm. By real facts,
like,
not alternative
not
facts.
Not alternative facts. So yeah, I mean, I think it really boils down to how Republican leaders react. Like, that's always what it's been about, you know?
Right.
And Apparently, sources close to John Kasich told Willie Geist that there is a growing sense of quote-unquote moral imperative to primary Trump in 2020.
Why wait until 2020? I mean, exactly. If this is such a moral imperative, like, let's handle this shit now.
Yeah, they're like, in 2 years, we might act.
Oh,
and we might primary him.
Maybe in 2 years we might primary him.
That's our moral imperative as defined by Republicans.
Great, well done.
Yeah,
well done, Republicans.
And it's like, oh, right. That's because all Republicans care about is maintaining power.
Oh,
like, of course.
Yes, that makes sense.
Of course, you know.
Okay.
And there were quote unquote alt-right rallies scheduled at 9 Google facilities across the country this weekend, but they've been canceled or postponed because of all that's been happening. And that's good, but it still feels like things could get a whole lot worse before they get better.
Yeah.
Like, that's what is concerning about this, is that Trump is not coming out strongly against Nazis, like, and Republicans are pretty silent.
Yeah.
You know? Again, all they care about is fucking tax reform.
Right.
That's all they care about.
And it's sort of a self-reinforcing thing, like, you know, he doesn't come out against Nazis and no one challenges him on that. Mm-hmm. And it's just sort of this cycle that keeps going. And all of that being said, I took away a lot of hope and inspiration from Heather Heyer's mother, Susan Breaux.
Yeah.
She gave an incredibly brave speech at her memorial on Wednesday. And she said, quote, "I'd rather have my child, but if I've got to give her up, by golly, we're going to make it count."
I started crying when I was watching that.
I mean, again, I don't know if you guys know, but I'm a mother.
Yeah.
But honestly, the fact that she was able to stand up and say that,
mm-hmm.
You know, I can't imagine the pain of losing a child.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, she's known her daughter for 32 years, mm-hmm. like, and losing her, like, just overnight. Saying that if I have to give her up, we're going to make it count.
I know.
Really just shows me how dedicated, you know, we need to be. Because let's remember,
how dedicated
Heather was and how dedicated her mother is. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, she also said, "They tried to kill my child to shut her up. Well, guess what? You just magnified her."
Yeah.
So that is something I'll definitely remember for a long while.
Okay, so we're really excited to introduce our guest for today, Matthew Cherry. Matthew Cherry is a former NFL wide receiver turned filmmaker who played for the Jacksonville Jaguars, the Cincinnati Bengals, the Carolina Panthers, and the Baltimore Ravens. In 2007, he retired and moved to LA to pursue a career in entertainment, landing work as a production assistant on over 40 commercials and as an assistant director for over 20 music videos. Matthew is also an award-winning feature filmmaker whose current project, Hair Love, recently became the most funded short film in Kickstarter history. So welcome to Hellbent.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course.
We also just discovered that Matthew lives in LA.
Yes.
And in the same neighborhood
area
as Devin. So it's quite possible that we're like only a couple houses down, even though we're doing this on Skype right now.
No worries.
Funny.
All good.
Yeah, so first of all, how much money did you set out to raise for Hair Love? And how much money did you end up raising? And how do you describe in words the massive support that you've received on this project?
Yeah, so the initial goal was set for $75,000. The goal, though, was always to try to get up to at least $100,000, because a lot of times with like Kickstarter, I don't know if people know this, but you know, if you don't hit your goal, then you don't get anything. So sometimes it's better to kind of set your goal
lower,
so that and you can always raise more. And
right.
So the goal was $75,000. Then we ended up raising $284,000.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was pretty wild.
When did that end? Because it just ended recently, right?
It ended about a week ago.
Oh, wow.
Last Wednesday, I believe.
Wow.
Did you expect it to take off so in such a big way?
I definitely thought that it would do well.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely thought we could hit at least six figures. I mean, to do, you know, 300-400% of what the initial goal was set up. You know, I don't think anybody thought it was going to do
it's
that.
It's amazing. Yeah.
It's been pretty incredible.
So what is the inspiration behind Hair Love and how did it come to be?
I mean, it's pretty simple. You know, Hair and Love really just was inspired by a lot of these viral videos I was seeing kind of on my timeline. You know, I've had the idea for a couple of years. I always thought doing a short film that was fairly simple. You know, I always like watch animated feature films, and you always see like those little cute short films that play in front of them. And I always wanted to do one like that. And I don't know. I just like always thought that the idea of like a dad trying to figure out how to do his daughter's hair would be like a really cute idea. And then I just recently started coming across a lot of viral videos of dads doing their kids' hair, and they would always perform like crazy. Even when we did, I kind of teased the artwork like a week before we launched the campaign, and each little picture and post like would do like 10, 20,000 likes on Twitter.
Yeah, I love the art.
Yeah, the art is really awesome.
Love the art.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, yeah. No, shout out to Vashti Harrison who did it. And yeah, so I, you know, the idea was just really a combination of a few things. It was wanting to show more representation in the animated space. You know, I felt like a lot of times, like you'll have, you know, penguins talking and cats and dogs and dragons and all kind of stuff, but you rarely see people of color in lead roles in a lot of these animated short films. You know, animation is probably one of the least diverse fields as it relates to, like, you know, actual directors and kind of people that make the decisions in that world. You know, it's literally just, you know, it's literally like older white men that kind of run that game. And so, you know, as a black person, and I think as a person of color, you can't expect an older white guy to want to do a story that tells your story. You know, you kind of got to step up and tell it yourself if you want to see yourself represented.
Right.
So that was like really the big reason why, you know, I thought this film was important and why we wanted to do it in the way that we did, you know, it prominently featuring a African-American father doing his daughter's hair.
So what's the vision for the film? Like, what's the story that is going to be told through the film?
Well, all that I can share is that, okay. You know, because it's only a 5-minute short.
Right. That's fair.
But all that I can really share is that, you know, it just is a short film about an African-American father trying to figure out how to do his daughter's hair for the first time. And, you know, he thinks it's going to be easy. And he comes to find that her hair has a mind of its own.
I love that.
I really love that. And you're not a father yet. So how has developing this project impacted your perspective on fatherhood itself and a dad's role in raising daughters?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think as a filmmaker, you know, you don't necessarily have to be everything that, you know, your films are about. You know, I think the biggest thing about being a filmmaker is having empathy.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a man who, you know, knows a lot of younger kids, that knows a lot of young fathers, and also, you know, will hopefully have kids myself one day, you know, you want to create images that your kids can look up to. You know, I wanted to do something to where, you know, if I have a daughter, she could look at this project and look at Zuri, who's our main character, see that she's proud of her hair and have pride in her own hair as well.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of feeds into the next question, which is, you know, when we heard about this project, we immediately thought of black hair discrimination, which shows up in school, workplaces, etc. So in what ways, directly or indirectly, does Hair Love address these biases and that persist throughout society?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think the biggest thing with anything when it comes to being a filmmaker in media in general is just you know, creating a human element to things that people that may not be a part of that world can see. So my thing is, you know, think about it like this. Like, if you're a little African-American girl, you grow up, you turn on your TV, you're going to see movies, you're going to see TV shows, you're going to look down at your coffee table, you're going to see magazines, you're going to, you know, you're inundated with all these images, and 9 times out of 10, these images have a very Eurocentric standard of beauty. They don't see themselves represented. And so that will, in turn, when you go to look at yourself in the mirror and you don't see things where, oh, woman of the year on GQ, she doesn't have my type of hair. Oh, I'm turning on this TV show, this lead actress doesn't have my kind of hair. You know, it starts to affect your self-confidence. And so I think my biggest thing that I want to do with this project is just really, I think there's power in just like simplicity and normalcy. You know, like the simple act of a dad trying to do his daughter's hair, while our plot is simple, to me is very humanizing. And I think that it could do wonders in just creating a normalcy in that, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely.
So what inspired you to work in film and entertainment after retiring from professional football?
Well, I didn't know exactly that I was going to be a filmmaker when I retired. I knew that I wanted to work in entertainment. And I heard about this program called Streetlights. And to take a couple steps before that, I studied radio, TV broadcast, and media production in college. So I worked at a lot of radio stations, a lot of kind of random jobs. Like I DJed before. I used to cut like the promo commercials and things like that. So, you know, it's all kind of connected, you know, whether you're shooting film or you're dealing with audio. And so I knew, like, when I retired that I wanted to work in something in entertainment. I didn't know if it was going to be the music industry, radio, film, TV, et cetera. But, you know, I knew it was going to be something. And I knew very quickly when I was in the NFL that my time was going to be limited, just kind of the way that I came in. You know, I was an undrafted free agent, came from a smaller school. A lot of times that's like the equivalent to being a walk-on, mm-hmm. where, you know, they don't give you the same opportunities that they give, like, other players that they're paying millions of dollars. And so, you know, I just always thought about this as my plan B if football didn't work out. And I moved to L.A., you know, 10 years ago, almost to the day. And, you know, just really wanted to learn the business from the ground up and kind of see what would interest me. And being a production assistant is great in that you're literally interacting with every department. You're trying to figure out what you want to do. You know, you can ask a lot of questions and people will answer them for the most part. And honestly, being on a lot of these sets, there was this one TV show I was a PA on called Heroes.
Yes.
Which, Heroes.
Yeah, yeah. Save the cheerleaders, save the world.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so I was a PA on that show for the third season. After it jumped the shark, though. It jumped the shark after the first season.
Right, when it's like the carnival and they're,
Yeah, that whole time travel thing kind of messed it up. But that's a side note. Anyway.
Devin can get on all kinds of side notes when it comes to that kind of stuff.
I can. Yeah. That is true.
No, but it was just, it was cool, though, because, like, you know, I'd worked prior to working on Heroes. I worked on a show called Girlfriends, which came on the CW and UPN with Mara Brock-Akil. So, you know, black woman showrunner, all black cast for the most part. So I expected to see black directors on that show. And so when that show got canceled and I went to Heroes, I'm like, okay, this is a huge NBC network show, mostly white cast. Like, I don't, and a sci-fi. I didn't really expect to see a lot of black directors, but the showrunner, Tim Kring, was actually a huge fan of The Wire. Mm. And so he brought on like 3 and 4 different African-American directors that directed on The Wire to direct episodes of Hero. And that was like the first time that I really, I don't know, like a light bulb went off and like, wow, they letting people like me direct shows like this.
Yeah.
You know, maybe this is something that I can, you know, pursue further and just, you know, ask the advice of these guys. And they were all really cool. And just from there, just kind of started doing my first music videos and it's just kind of a progression from that.
Wow.
That's awesome.
That is awesome. What was your favorite project? I know they're all so different, but what was your favorite project that you worked on, either like as a PA or a director?
Something else, yeah.
Oh, wow. I directed a music video that Beyonce was in. I mean,
that's up there.
That's pretty fantastic.
It was definitely a, you know, challenging shoot in that it wasn't in LA and we were dealing with like a lot of elements, but it was just an incredible experience, you know.
Which video?
I directed a video for Michelle Williams that featured Beyonce and Kelly.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
They could officially say Destiny's Child.
Right.
Because I think their father owns the name or whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
So it was Michelle Williams featuring Beyonce and Kelly Rowland, but the song was called Say Yes.
Oh, awesome.
That's awesome.
That's really awesome.
Check it out.
I definitely will.
We will. So what do you miss about being a football player? And then also, what do you appreciate about not being a professional athlete anymore? Like, how has that adjustment been from professional athlete to filmmaker? Yeah.
You know what's so interesting about because I get this question a lot.
Yeah.
as you can imagine.
Yes. Yes.
It's actually really similar in that it's very team oriented, mm-hmm. you know, like literally every piece of the puzzle is crucial to like your success on the field or on the screen. You know, in football, if you like, I was a wide receiver, so if I run a great route, if I beat my man, if a lineman messes up and he lets his guy get by him, the play, you know, won't work because now the quarterback got sacked.
Right.
It's really the same thing in film. Like, you can have an incredible take, the actors could be hitting it, but if the focus puller buzzes the focus and now the footage is blurry, we can't use that take.
Right.
And so it's like literally just trying to get, you know, 100 different people to kind of like work in unison for like that perfect take on a consistent basis. And I think that's really the biggest similarity. In terms of things I miss, I don't know. I mean, it's like you get paid to work out, essentially. that's like a big thing, you know. Like, I'm not an actor or anything, and I see how actors get motivated to just be in the gym all the time, and being behind the camera, you don't have that same motivation. Yeah. So, you know, I think that's probably the thing I miss the most.
Yeah. So who are you rooting for this season?
I really root for everybody that I used to play for.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
I'm from Chicago, so I used to really root for the Bears. But yeah. It's like once you actually play, it kind of gives you a different perspective.
Yeah.
And so, like, the two teams that I was with the longest were the Bengals and the Jaguars. So those are probably the two biggest teams that I root for.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're wearing a Bengals shirt right now. So that seems to be maybe the answer for today, at least.
It just so happens.
What is your advice to young people who want to follow in your footsteps and be a filmmaker and work in the entertainment industry?
I mean, I would say to start now. You know, the timing will never be perfect. You'll never have enough money. You could always use more. You can always... Like film is interesting in that you can have $100 million, you'll still feel like you don't have enough resources. The biggest thing I would say is, like, work now, you know, do it now. I shot a movie called Nine Rides on 2 iPhone 6s.
Wow.
Could have shot it on regular cameras, but we shot it on 2 iPhones. It premiered at South by Southwest. Just got picked up for distribution.
Is this the last fall?
No. Last fall was my first movie. Nine Rides we shot.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. So, you know what I mean? And my thing is, like, we really did that not because we had to shoot with an iPhone, because we probably could have rented something, you know, better, you know, essentially. But for me, the biggest thing was, particularly for filmmakers of color who don't have access to a lot of the same resources a lot of times, was just to be like, look, if you have an iPhone in your pocket, you know, you can actually go out and use that to push yourself forward in the industry. Like, you know, I did my movie last fall. I did all these music videos, but it was a movie that I shot on iPhones that actually got me my agent at ICM.
Right.
Wow.
So things like that. You know, I feel like the older you get, the more responsibilities you have, the more your creativity is kind of stifled in a way.
Mm-hmm.
People are telling you that stuff isn't realistic. And I feel like if you were like a 16-year-old filmmaker that didn't have to worry about bills and you were just like fully operating on a high creativity level, make your movie then. You know, you might mess around and win an Oscar. You never know.
Yeah, I feel like some of the most creative things I've seen have come on Vine, for example.
Yeah.
Like 7 seconds.
Yeah.
Six or 7 seconds it loops.
And right.
People are so creative with that.
I mean, I think the biggest problem I think that a lot of younger people have is they feel like there's some level of paying their dues that they have to do. Oh, I didn't go to film school yet, so I can't make a movie. And it's like, I think we're probably some of the most creative because they don't know any better. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you think about 20, 30 years ago, you had to shoot on film. You had to, like, rent an editing bay and splice the film with, like, a razor blade and all this other crazy stuff.
Like,
now you can shoot a movie on your iPhone, edit it on your laptop.
Yeah.
You can upload it online if you want to. Like, you know, it's way more accessible. For filmmakers, it's just really not that. It's really not an excuse to not be making movies if you really want to.
Yeah, just create stuff.
Absolutely.
It's funny because my boyfriend is a video game designer, so he gets a lot of people coming to him who want to work in video games, and that's always his advice is just make a game. It can be any game. It can be whatever you want. Just make something.
Right.
Get that practice. Show what you can. Show what you're made of, and like work from there. And I think that's great advice.
Yeah, I mean, because I also feel like, you know, everybody has ideas. You know, we all have great ideas, but once you make it real, once it's like an actual link that you can send to people, like, that shows people that you're serious.
Yes.
And way more willing to help people that are helping themselves.
For sure.
You know, there's this great example that I think Chris Rock told this story. He was like, you know, back in the day, I was this broke comedian and my car would break down all the time. And I would stand on the side of the road and I'd put my thumb up. Like, people would just, like, drive right past me. Like, nobody would help. As soon as I started pushing my own car, people would always pull over
and they
would help me.
That's super interesting.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great example of that. You know, people want to help people that they see are helping themselves, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And having that sort of portfolio, even if you don't feel like it's super polished, being able to show something is so important.
And, like, a progression.
Yeah, a progression of work. So to close off every interview, we like to ask our guests to share a gratitude check. So it's something we do every episode to sort of take stock of the good things that are happening in such dark times. So, so what are you grateful for right now?
I'm grateful that this Kickstarter campaign was successful, not because of anything having to do with like me personally or trying to make the movie. I'm just glad that people are excited at the possibility of seeing themselves represented in a space that they normally don't see themselves represented by. You know, the messages and all the stories that we got from people like, man, I wish we had a story like this when I was growing up. You know, I can't wait for, you know, my daughter to meet her new best friend. Like, aww. You know, like stories like that just really give you perspective on how big it is what you're doing and how it's bigger than you.
Yeah.
So just grateful for the opportunity that, you know, to kind of hopefully change some lives.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really beautiful.
It is.
I love that. Well, thank you to Matthew Cherry for joining us today on Hellbent. You can follow him on Twitter it's Matthew A. Cherry 2. What's going on with your main account?
Man, yeah, they're trying to get me for posting videos of dads doing their daughter's hair. So
because of the music that was used?
Yeah, stuff like that. So, yes, Matthew A. Cherry 2 for now, and hopefully I'll be able to get the original Matthew A. Cherry back up.
Yeah, I hope so, too.
Yeah.
And Matthew, how can people continue to support Hair Love, and when can we see the final product?
Yeah, the film probably won't come out until middle of next year.
Okay.
At some point, probably next summer or next fall, but... yeah, just continue to follow us on social media and we'll give you guys updates. So, yeah.
Awesome.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay, Sarah, that was an awesome interview with Matthew Cherry.
It was really fun chatting with him.
It was. It was really cool. So let's get into our gratitude check for today. Sorely needed in this dark political time. So, Sarah, what are you grateful for?
So the first thing I'm grateful for is the state of Oregon. So Oregon became the first state to make abortion accessible to all women.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, so on Tuesday, Governor Kate Brown signed the Reproductive Health Equity Act, which is HB 3391. She signed it into law, and it effectively requires all insurance companies to cover abortion for Oregon citizens and undocumented residents alike. Yeah, so this law also extends beyond abortion, and so it includes stuff like birth control, postpartum care, and a whole host of other things. That will be available at no additional cost to the patient.
Wow.
And it also allocates tax money to provide reproductive health care to those who are uninsured.
Wow. So she's just really checking all the boxes.
All the boxes. So some downer news on this note, though. On the same day that what is known as the most progressive abortion legislation in history passed in Oregon, the one we were talking about, Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed a bill into law prohibiting all insurance companies in the state from covering abortion except in quote-unquote life-threatening cases.
Jesus fucking Christ.
And this forces women to purchase outside coverage for abortion care, even in instances of rape or incest.
I have no words.
Like, I think I tweeted that story yesterday, and I was just like, fuck you, Texas.
Yeah.
Like, I just didn't have anything more eloquent to say.
Right?
Like, I was just like, you can go fuck yourself.
Yeah. Seriously.
Greg Abbott. That is obviously some bull-ass shit and some, you know, real dickwad move.
That's a dickwad move if I ever heard one.
A pretty big dickwad move. But there is, you know, speaking of Texas, there is actually some good news coming out of the state.
So man, really a mixed bag today.
Really a mixed bag. But that goes into my second gratitude check.
Okay.
So an anti-trans quote-unquote bathroom bill failed in Texas. Measures were blocked by moderate House Republicans after business leaders and civil rights groups had battled to defeat the bills, saying that they advance bigotry and would tarnish the state's image and damage its economy.
Wow, so that sounds like really smart people.
Basically, they were like, this fucking makes no sense on any level.
Right. Like, and it doesn't help us. It only hurts us. It
doesn't help anyone. So, yeah, like, obviously this legislation, you know, this kind of legislation is morally abhorrent. But also, Texas could have lost about $5.6 billion through 2026 if it had enacted a law, or such a law. And this is according to the Texas Association of Business.
Hey, sometimes you gotta hit them where it hurts the most, which is the wallet.
But that's the thing. It's like, it doesn't make sense economically. It doesn't make sense morally. Like, there's really no reason to do this at all. You know, and this is significant not only because it halts this kind of discrimination against trans people in Texas, but also because such a populous and deeply Republican state, passing such a bill could have created a big ripple effect in other conservative states.
Right.
I mean, we saw what happened in North Carolina, and, you know, they're trying to repeal, or they have repealed, or that bathroom bill in North Carolina, but a lot of people say it doesn't go far enough.
Right, and they really only did it because they wanted the
NCAA
to back.
Reinstate some business.
Yeah.
So yeah, for now, morality and what should be common sense has won. So yeah, really a mixed bag of Texas, but you know, again, local politics.
Sexy.
Local politics is where it's at. And
you can really affect real change.
Well, yeah, and like kudos to these, you know, civil rights groups and business leaders who pushed against this bill and made sure it failed. So
yeah,
awesome stuff there. Okay, so what are you grateful for today?
All right, well, I have two. One is really fun and silly, mm-hmm. and the other one is more serious.
Okay.
So the first thing I'm grateful for was a New Yorker like satirical article entitled "Advance Praise for Hillary's New Book."
Oh yeah, I saw that. That was really funny.
So I'm just gonna read two of my favorite ones.
Like these are like fake reviewers.
They're fake reviewers who are book come that what happened that's coming out.
That's coming out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you know how you'll get advance praise for a book, it'll be like, this was the most eloquent book ever written, and it's by some other author.
Right.
So these are fake ones. I'm going to read my two favorite ones as my gratitude check because they're so amazing. The first one, quote, yeah, it's obviously a great book, but are they even advertising it in Wisconsin?
Oh my God.
How are people going to know that they should choose to buy this book rather than, say, a piece of paper covered in incoherent riddles and poison?
That's so real.
And then the second one, quote, I purchased this book, but I do think it is morally bereft and evil. I guess if I were to compare it to, like, Lolita, a book about someone who lusts after his own stepdaughter, it's not as bad.
Oh my God.
In fact, I'd argue that this book is the lesser of two evils, if only because this book never describes at length the desire to look at underage girls undressing. But I can confidently say that that is the only difference.
Oh my God, that's so real.
So real.
So real.
And, you know, it's only funny because it's so sad.
It's only funny because it's true.
Exactly. And I just thought it was such like a clever way to, you know, the sort of Hillary smash cuts.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like everyone who didn't vote for Hillary is looking worse and worse.
Oh, I know.
And I don't take any pleasure in being right.
Not even schadenfreude, y'all?
No, because I'm like, fuck this.
I know.
Trump should never
have been a problem.
Trump should never have been president.
Yeah.
That's how I feel.
But I can confidently say that the only difference is, you know, that lesser of two evils.
Oh, right. There is no difference between
There's
Trump
no
and
difference.
Glenn. Yeah, they're the same.
Yeah, mm-hmm. They're the same.
Yep.
And so the second thing I'm grateful for is actually an op-ed in the Washington Post.
Yes.
It was written by Karen Atiyah. And she wrote, what if the media covered Charlottesville the way we cover other nations?
Yeah.
So it was great. So she writes about Charlottesville in a way that a newspaper would write about a similar event in another country, say Africa or China.
Mm-hmm.
She takes this kind of detached, pedantic tone and consults with fictional experts about the state of affairs in the U.S.
Yeah.
And it's really fascinating because you recognize the style that she's writing in. Like, it's very reminiscent of, like, a BBC article, mm-hmm. kind of, you know, no emotion,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know, just reporting the events. So the second paragraph when she describes Trump through that sort of tone is just spot on.
Like, on point?
On point. So she says, quote, Trump, a former reality television host, beauty pageant organizer, and businessman, rose to political prominence by publicly questioning the citizenship of the United States' first black president, Barack Obama. Since his election, Trump has targeted Muslims, refugees, Mexicans, and the media. He has also advocated for police brutality. These tactics have appealed to and emboldened white ethno-nationalist groups and domestic terrorist organizations.
I mean, yeah.
It's just such this beautiful, like, deadpan sort of...
This is the way he should be described.
Exactly. And so what it really does is point out the way that the media sort of handles Trump in this country, which is with kid gloves and sort of almost perverse excitement.
Yeah, and then the way, how that differs from the way we cover other countries.
Exactly.
Like, kind of looking down on them.
Exactly, and mm-hmm. sort of detaching. And it, like I kind of I alluded to before, there's sort of this like insidious symbiotic relationship between Trump and the media.
Yeah.
And sort of how they don't really know what to do with him.
Well, I mean, like the media is a business, right?
Right, exactly.
We've talked about that with, I think, Sarah Kendzior.
Yeah, and Trump generates page views.
And revenue.
And revenue, right. Ultimately, that leads to revenue. So, you know, we don't take this sort of detached, pedantic tone.
And I think also, too, it's what we were talking about, which the fact that our mainstream media is mostly white.
White. And
so they don't know how to talk about
it. And they don't know
things.
How to dig into these issues in any real way.
Right.
And so while the experts are not real in this article, their perspectives are definitely chilling.
Mm-hmm.
So... one was, quote, "The Americans on both sides of the political spectrum like to talk about identity politics or white identity," said Mustafa Okongo, a Kenyan anthropologist based in Nairobi. "The Americans like to lecture us and other Africans about keeping tribalism out of our politics and putting country ahead of our ethnic groups. America's institutions are strong. But when I saw the images of those white men in polos carrying Party City tiki torches and weapons, it's pretty clear American white tribal politics are alive and well, explicitly fueled by President Trump's regime.
Mm.
White supremacy doesn't just hurt blacks or other minority groups. It hurts the whole country. Take it from us Kenyans. It's a dangerous recipe. We had hoped better for America."
I mean, that's so real. I mean, this, the sort of white nationalism, white sort of tribalism that is described, that never gets written about
exactly
from our media.
But we would totally go to an expert to talk about
what's going on in another country.
Right. They talk about this sort of like ethnocentric violence, and we'd go to an expert and have them talk about it.
Right.
But we don't do that.
We don't self-reflect.
Exactly. So I just thought that was such a great op-ed that kind of forced that sort of self-reflection.
And conversation.
Yeah. So I thought that was a really great article.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go into our listener gratitude checks. So who's the first one?
I was going to say, can I do this one? So Jillian from the Facebook group, she said, quote, "I'm starting my third year of law school on Monday and decided to adopt this little floof," and it's a little baby kitty.
Oh my God.
She said, "Presenting the Honorable Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court."
Court. That's really cute. Oh,
made my day.
That's, yeah. And I love kittens, and
you do.
I can't have one because Nick's allergic.
I know.
And that's really hard for me.
I know. Well, you know, you can always have my Harold, my kitty.
I do. I come over to Devin's house and I just start petting her cat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, Harold. I don't even say hi to Devin. I'm like, hi, Harold.
Yeah, exactly.
Andrea is our second one, and she said, quote, "This is a personal one, but I had my 20-week ultrasound yesterday. In addition to finding out that we have a perfectly healthy baby, we found out we're having a girl. I obviously would have been happy no matter what, but I'm excited to bring another member into the sisterhood."
That's so sweet.
That's really, really sweet.
And then our last one is from May. She said, quote, "I'm grateful Asian Americans are speaking out. I want us to be more engaged in politics and activism in general, and I'm always happy to see awareness and solidarity, and specifically calling out how this kind of racism and white supremacy are deeply intertwined in our history. Don't think this doesn't affect us. Don't sit by in silence."
I love that.
Yeah, me too.
Such a great way to put it.
Okay, Sarah, so it is Thursday, and so on Thursdays we wear pink. No, just kidding. On Thursdays we honor the Hellion of the Week. So who is it this week?
Yeah, and as we kind of mentioned, and for those who don't know, we call our listeners
Hellions.
And us, too, Hellions.
Yes.
Isn't it funny that I initially was like, let's call us Hellbenters.
And I was like, we're not doing that.
And I didn't even know that Hellion was a word.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait, yours is way better. Let's go with Hellion.
Yeah, right.
And for those who don't know, Hellion is kind of means troublemaker.
Yeah.
And we think of it in a good way.
Exactly.
Because well-behaved women seldom make history.
That's true.
So Hellion of the Week. So our Hellion of the Week this week is Takiya Thompson. So she, along with a group of activists, took down the Confederate Soldiers Monument in downtown Durham by climbing on the statue and wrapping a strap around its neck, and then it was pulled to the ground and toppled by fellow protesters on the ground.
Yeah, she was arrested for her efforts, and she said that in a subsequent media interview, quote, "I'm tired of white supremacy keeping its foot on my neck and the necks of people who look like me. That statue glorifies the conditions that oppressed people live in, and it had to go. Anything that emboldens those people needs to be crushed."
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
And, you know, for those who may think it's wrong to tear down public property, I'm going to give you this Bree Newsom tweet. She said, quote, "It's important to recognize that statues themselves represent systemic racism, and laws created to protect them are systemic racism." And I mean, we see it in North Carolina where this happened. You know, former Republican Governor Pat McCrory had signed a law that prevents these kind of monuments from being removed without permission from the Historical Commission of the state. So, you know, this is a protection of symbols of white supremacy. Like, that's by design.
Right. A feature, not a bug.
Yeah. So nothing happens in a vacuum.
Like, right.
They all sort of interconnect. So, you know, I'm all for, you know, people taking down Confederate statues.
My only concern is that that people do it safely.
Yeah, that's fair.
You know, these are big, heavy bronze statues, and I just don't want anyone getting hurt.
Yeah, I don't know what the material is for all of them.
Not all of them.
They are heavy statues, and that's definitely a valid concern. And,
I agree.
You know, there are, you know, she and a couple of others have been arrested.
Yes.
So we'll have some action items around this story and how you can support these activists. All right, Devin, so let's get into some action items. So stuff our Hellions can do after they're done listening to us.
So this one is related to our Hellion of the Week story.
Yes.
If you go to durhamsolidaritycenter.org/bondfund and donate, you can help with the legal fees that Takiyah Thompson and other protesters have incurred from being arrested for taking down the Confederate statue in Durham.
Yeah.
And then speaking of Confederate symbols, the Southern Poverty Law Center began collecting data in 2016, and they found that there are over 1,500 places or things commemorating the Confederacy, including more than 100 schools and 700 monuments.
Over 700 monuments.
Like, what?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I just love the, like, fetishization of this, like, failed rebellion.
And when you say love, you
mean... I mean hate.
Yeah.
So if you familiarize yourself with these sort of Confederate symbols and where they exist in your area, just call your reps and demand that they be removed.
Yeah, and actually, 538 had a map of all these symbols and statues and monuments, and they also showed where it's already been considered for removal, or it's been approved for removal, or where it hasn't been. So yeah, definitely a good thing to do right now.
Yeah, and there are these symbols and monuments everywhere.
Oh,
it's not just in the South. It's not just where...
They're in California.
Yeah, absolutely. So everyone can kind of take a look and call your reps.
It's almost like it's a systemic American problem.
What?
Yep.
That doesn't sound right.
Oh, it's right. Also, as Indivisible tweeted, so this is our next action item, quote, "Words don't go far enough in condemning Trump's response to Charlottesville. Urge your House reps to sign on the bill to censure Trump." And so for some context here, Representatives Gerald Nadler, Representatives Gerald Nadler, Bonnie Watson, and then Pramila Jayapal announced a resolution of censure against Trump on Wednesday that also urges him to, quote, "fire any and all White House advisors who have urged him to cater to the quote-unquote alt-right movement in the United States."
So he'd have to fire himself.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, there's this whole call to, like, fire Bannon and Miller and...
Gorka.
And so, yeah, I mean, that's good, but it doesn't mean that white supremacy doesn't still exist in the White House, right?
Like, exactly.
Like you said, I mean, the fish rots from the head.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so censure, for those of you who might not know what it means.
And I will admit, I was one of them who wasn't quite clear.
Yeah.
I was doing a lot of Googling.
Yeah, right? Night. Like, what is censure?
It was actually kind of hard to just get, like, a good definition.
Yeah. It's not impeachment. Yeah. It is essentially a formal condemnation. So it's kind of like the principal putting something in your permanent record.
In a way. Like, it's just like...
It's just like this go... Like,
it's an official sort of, like, rebuke, basically.
Yeah. And only one president in U.S. history has ever been censured, and that was Andrew Jackson in 1834. He is a special class of dickwad.
He's quite a dickwad. So
yeah.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
It definitely makes sense. So yeah, definitely call your reps. Urge them to sign on to what the three reps that we mentioned are doing with this resolution. Finally... this week marked the 5-year anniversary of DACA. So courtesy of United We Dream, this is how you can defend DACA. So there's two things you can do immediately.
You can call your state attorney general and ask them to publicly support the DACA program. And
then you can also share why DACA is important to you with hashtag here to stay and or hashtag defend DACA. So definitely, you know, a good thing to sign your name onto and to make sure that the Trump administration isn't coming up after these key programs.
Right. And a lot of this, if you'll notice, is local. Mm-hmm. These are things you can do locally in your community, your mm-hmm. local reps, like really push for change where you are.
Yeah. Local politics is where it's at.
It's sexy.
Yes. Okay, so that's it for us today. Thank you to Matthew Cherry for the interview. It was really fun to chat with him.
It was.
And we will see you back on Monday.
For more information on today's episode, please visit our website at www.hellbentpodcast.com. You'll find the articles we discussed as well as additional resources. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at HellbentPod, and you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/HellbentPodcast. We also have a fan group called Dickwads Be Gone, which you can find on Facebook.
Please listen on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just like the rules of feminism. We also have a Patreon, and you can find us at patreon.com/HellbentPodcast. You can support us for as little as $1 a month, and for $5 a month, you get access to exclusive content, mini podcasts, and behind-the-scenes looks at the making of Hellbent.